As I was kind of thinking about this passage and the series that we're going through, it made me remember. It reminded me that all of us have had these experiences of not fitting in, you know, being in the wrong place or you know, something where we just, you know, for whatever reason, we felt uncomfortable and we didn't kind of fit in with everyone else around us. For a lot of us, it's stories of being at the wrong place or at the wrong time or dressed the wrong way for something, some event. For me, I was in college one time and I went into the wrong classroom and I sat there for about 10 minutes. And luckily, I was kind of not really in the back, but I was towards the back and I could kind of sneak out when I realized this wasn't my class, even though people had to get up. I mean, all of us have had kind of humorous experiences like that. But there are more serious examples of that, you know. I won't give a lot of examples of that, but essentially, in the series that we're going through the book of Daniel, the book of Daniel reminds us that, in a lot of ways, I mean, faith makes us different. You know, it makes us not like everyone else that we're around, and sometimes that's a great thing, but sometimes it makes us feel like we stand out. And for, you know, for the people that Daniel's addressing, for the Jewish believers, they feel like that all the time. I mean, they're not living in their homeland. They're not living in their beloved Jerusalem. They've been exiled to this foreign country. And so here they are, you know, Jewish believers living in this pagan polytheistic society in exile. And so for them, I mean, every day is an experience of discomfort. Every day is an experience of feeling like they don't fit in with everyone else around them. One of my favorite examples of this is 2004, Ravi Zacharias got an invitation to speak at the Mormon Tabernacle, which is very rare for someone who's not a Mormon. And he agreed to do it on certain conditions. One of the conditions is that he could speak on what he wanted to speak about, and they could bring someone in to lead the music for that service that he was going to be speaking for. And so they agreed to it. He invited Michael Card to come, and I think I've mentioned Michael Card a few times, Christian musician. And Michael Card led the music for it. You know, so as a Christian leading worship in the Mormon Tabernacle, his highlight song was a song that he had just written called "I Am Not Supposed to Be Here." That's perfect, you know, perfect example of what he felt. It wasn't actually about his experience there. It was actually about the Apostle Peter experiencing this thing where he goes to the house and God opens up the faith to Gentiles also. But you know, there are a lot of ways in which, you know, our faith makes us feel like that. You know, we look around and we say, I don't know if I'm supposed to be here. I don't know if I feel comfortable in this setting. And that's really what we're trying to address with this new series. The new series that we've been going through in Daniel is called Faith in a Faithless World. And in a lot of ways, it's trying to address that challenge that you and I experience today of how do we live out our beliefs, our convictions, in the midst of a world that doesn't believe in God, in a world that in a lot of ways has rejected God. And today we're going through Daniel chapter 3, and it's actually not as easy as it seems. You know, for most of us, we've heard the Sunday school story about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and the end of the story, they end up going to the furnace. They're firm in their faith, they're faithful to the end, and God preserves them, and we're not actually going to talk a lot about that, but it's actually a very, very difficult passage because, like us, I mean, their faith puts them at odds with the world around them. The difficult thing that we have is we're really not in the same context, and so we're going to have to kind of work and figure out what this means for us because there aren't a lot of similarities for us in terms of our place in the world is there. So we're going to do a little bit of work, and it might be a little bit of a wrestling match to kind of get us there. But today, as we go through this again, we're not going to really focus intensely on the very end of the story, but we are going to look at kind of what leads them there, essentially where faith takes them in the midst of this conflict, where faith hits squarely against unbelief. And so the first, you know, I think the first thing that we see as we start into the story, as we see kind of what's happening, is we see that for Daniel's friends, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and for us, a lot of times faith is incongruous with culture, right? Our faith, it doesn't line up with the values, the priorities, the beliefs of the surrounding culture. If you go into verses 1 through 6, we see that kind of building. It says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and breadth was 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to dedicate the image to the king of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And so basically we see this kind of building drama. In chapter 2, if you remember, Nebuchadnezzar has this dream of this statue. And each section of the statue is made of different material. And it's a dream about the kingdoms, about his kingdom, and the kingdoms going forward. Basically, years have passed from there, and we can tell because, you know, at the end of chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar praises Daniel's God. He hasn't converted. He praises Daniel's God. And now all of a sudden in verse 3, we have no time indicator, but he's making this essential, this idol. So something is, you know, so we need distance in there. Apparently years have passed, and he decides to build this monstrosity, right? It's basically a 90-foot statue made of gold. It's probably set in the center of the city so that people can see it no matter where they go, so that, you know, so that it's in a prominent place. It's not off to the side, it's not out back, it's not, you know, outside the walls. And he lays down a command. He says, when the music strikes, we are all to worship. And from, you know, the reading, you guys now know all the different instruments they had at that time period. But, you know, when the music played, they were all to bow and they were all to worship. And we actually see this happen in these first 6 verses. We see that citizens and civil servants and government officials all gather, and they actually, you know, the music plays and they all bow down and they worship. And in a very, very powerful way, it's this reminder that, you know, that faith and culture, that our faith and the culture around us are in conflict. You know, as you begin to read the story, you know, we haven't gotten to the furnace yet, but as you begin, even in its first couple, in the setup, first couple verses, you begin to feel this impending doom, right? Like, oh my gosh, you know, this is trouble, right? This is bad news that he's setting up this statue and he's starting to make these commands. It's kind of like, you know, first time I saw the third part of the Star Wars trilogy, Return of the Jedi, there's a scene there, which is, for those of you who aren't as old as me, it's the real Star Wars movies, the first 3, but in the third one, there's the scene where you begin to see that they're rebuilding the Death Star. And I remember that moment being a kid, I think I was 12 years old at the time, watching it with my friends. I remember that scene coming up and just going, oh no, right? I mean, that's what's happening here. We have this buildup of, you know, we see this golden statue go up, and we know it's bad news. We know that it's going to lead to some terrible things, and it's, again, it's a reminder that our faith and culture are going to be in conflict. And that doesn't mean that there's always a battle, that there's always conflict going on, but it is a reminder that even if we are in times of peace where we don't notice it, conflict is going to come because they're not the same thing, because the culture around us doesn't have the same values, the same priorities as our faith. You know, in the ancient Near East, you know, what you had was you had the Jews, you know, Judaism, it was monotheistic, and it was absolutely unique because of that. All the pagan religions were polytheistic. And if you remember, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, but when one nation would conquer another nation, they would have to figure out how to absorb the people that they conquered. And a lot of times, you know, it was a process of assimilation. right? How can we swallow them up? How can we make them a part of the whole? How can we get them to be loyal to us as a country? How can we change their identity so they see it? And one of the things that they always had to deal with was religion. Now, here's the interesting part is for every other religion at the time, it was not a big deal. Right? For the Babylonians to come in to conquer them, for Nebuchadnezzar to set up this golden statue, to say, everyone has to worship this. You know, if you're a part of my kingdom, then when the music plays, you have to bow and you have to genuflect, you have to pledge your allegiance to it. For every other religion except Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, you know, except for the Jewish believers, for every other religion, it was fine. It was fine because it was just one more god to add to their pantheon. It was just one more god to put on the shelf. It was just one more god that you would have to remember a particular day or particular practice. It was just one more to add to the slew of gods that you already had. And what's happening here is Nebuchadnezzar isn't setting himself up as a god. But in building the statue, it's a symbol of the greatness of their gods, of the Babylonian gods, of the nation as a whole. And to demand allegiance for all the rest of the pagans, it wasn't a big issue, right? Just one more. But what was not a problem for other religions was a major problem for the Jews, right? You had the Jews living in Babylon who were brought in exile, and for them, they couldn't add one more god because there was only one. And to add anything besides that one would be to deny that one. And it's very interesting, you know, as I was kind of thinking about this, it made me realize that there is, in a lot of ways, for the Jewish believers, the uniqueness of their faith is what caused the conflict. The fact that their beliefs were so unique, different than all the other pagan religions, that's actually what caused the conflict. And in a lot of ways, the same thing's true for us. You know, the Christian faith comes into conflict with the secular world because of its uniqueness, because it's not like other religions. You know, it comes into conflict because the gospel is different. Because Christianity doesn't have a message at the very bottom, at the very core, that says, be a good person. And because of that, any allegiance or any understanding that anything else will save or redeem is a problem. And that's one of the reasons why Christianity stands in conflict with atheism, right? But it also stands in conflict with other religions. It also stands in conflict with secularism. It also stands in conflict with pluralism. And the fact that our faith is unique is actually what causes the conflict with all these different things. You know, even for something like pluralism, you'd say, well, isn't pluralism a good thing, right? We have different people, different religions. Shouldn't we just kind of get along? Well, there's a problem. I mean, Christianity kind of butts up against this idea of pluralism, and other people realize it. Why? Because Christianity makes exclusive truth claims. And you can say other religions do too. But there's a difference. The moment you say Jesus is the only way, then we butt up against things. And you know, in a very real way, people have problems with that. They say, why can't you just embrace, you know, people of different religions? Why can't you just accept that there might be different ways to the same God? Why can't you just believe that maybe there are the possibility of different gods? And you know, to say that doesn't mean that for us to say Jesus is the only way, it doesn't mean that we should be belligerent, it doesn't mean that we should be inflexible, it doesn't mean that we should be judgmental. But at the same time, we need to understand that the message of Christianity is absolutely unique. You know, that there is something so unique, so special about the gospel, and unfortunately that brings us into conflict with everything else. Whether it's another religion, whether it's atheism, whether it's just the idea of pluralism, you know, that it creates these stresses and these problems and these challenges. And it makes sense. Again, you know, the message of Christianity isn't just about individual salvation, it's about a kingdom. So anytime it's about a kingdom, it's going to come in conflict with any other kingdom. But that's what we see in Daniel. And the question that kind of leads us to is, how do we posture ourselves then, right? If our faith is going to bring us in conflict with the society and the world around us, how do we kind of posture ourselves? And again, I don't think as Christians we should be belligerent. I don't think we should be difficult. For Daniel and his friends, they actually accept their place as believers living in a foreign land. They have no problems working in the positions that they are in. They have no problems doing things that are for the good of the Babylonians. But it is this kind of one issue that kind of comes up. And so that's really what I wanted to look at intensely and address. And so the second thing we see here is I think we see that there's a problem, and we need to kind of boil down what is the nature of the problem. Right? What's really the issue going on here? And once we understand that, we can start figuring out what that means for us. Because in a very interesting way, this passage to our lives isn't a one-to-one comparison. And again, I'll kind of try to flesh that out a little bit more later. But we do have, you know, like I said, the scene is set verses 1-6. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are under this tremendous pressure. Right? The king has built this statue. He's put out this royal command. And people have already gathered to worship this image, this idol. And when we get into verse 8 that we start reading, the Chaldeans kind of jump back into the picture and they tattle on the Jews. They say, you know, king, there's these people. I mean, you want us to all come and worship. You want us to all bow down. There's some people who aren't doing it. There are some people who they refuse. And so that's kind of where we pick up. In verse 8 it says, therefore, at that time certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so, I mean, we see everything kind of lay out in front of us, right? They come and they accuse the king, and we don't really, we're not told exactly why, but when you look into the previous chapters and when you look forward, it becomes obvious. I mean, there's a sense in which they are jealous. These men have risen far above their ranks, and they're foreigners. Right? I mean, there's a lot of enmity that's tied into that. And so they go tell the king, and the king is enraged. Right? He's absolutely, you know, he's angry, and he calls them in. Now, here's kind of the question that we have to wrestle with is, should they comply? Right? The king has come out with a decree. He said everyone has to come and worship this statue that we put up. And one of the questions we have to ask is, should they comply? And there's definitely ways that they could rationalize the answer to say, yes, we should. Right? They could go the route of Esther, and they could say, well, you know, God has put us in this position. Right? God has put us in this position where we are serving with influence, where we have this level of ability to do things, and we don't want to lose that opportunity. Right? Another way they could have rationalized it is they could say, you know what? I mean, we need to be in this position to help the exiles. I mean, if we're not here, someone else is going to do it, and someone else does it, they're not going to be concerned about what happens to, you know, our brethren, our brothers and sisters. They're going to do whatever they want to do, and it's going to be worse for them. And again, that makes sense. They could have also made the argument, they could have said, you know what? We know there's only one God. We know there's only one true God. And so, I mean, even if we bow down and even if we close our eyes and say these things, I mean, we know and he knows. I mean, it's just a game. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. Or they could say, you know, God knows the heart. Right? And those are very powerful rationalizations. The problem is this. The problem is that the nature of the problem strikes the very core of their faith. It's idolatry. Right? You know, they're asked to bow to this statue and to worship it. And you know, they understand that one of the overt themes of the Old Testament is that God had warned his people again and again and again and again not to worship idols, not to bow down to them, not to pretend that they're real, not to surrender their lives to them. And you know, this all of these warnings from God came because they were people living in the midst of pagans who had their own gods. And the rationale was there is really only one true God. And what we see is this very powerful reminder that to worship any other thing is a denial of the true thing. Right? To bow before any other thing is a denial of the one who is true. And so, you know, they could have made these rationalizations, but they couldn't. Because the very heart of the issue is idolatry, is their faith. Matter of fact, if you were to appeal to the Ten Commandments, you don't have to go very far. It's number one, right? You shall have no other gods before me. So what we have here is we have Jewish believers living in a Babylonian world. And in a lot of ways, if you can imagine, I mean, their faith was probably challenged all over the place. Probably different food practices, different ways of dealing with each other, different worship practices in terms of where they could go to worship, different practices of prayer, different practices of society, of propriety. And for the most part, they dealt with those. Now they're handed a situation that strikes at the very, very heart, the very core of their faith. And the question that comes up is this: when do we take a stand, right? When is something big enough? And you know, I'm going to give you a really unsatisfying answer to that. This passage really doesn't tell us. And the reason why is because it's about something so big and so obvious that it's hard to extrapolate that to all the other things. But we do know that this is a really important thing. We do know that it's a really big thing. I would give you the suggestion that, you know, if you are ever demanded to do something that causes you to disobey any of the Ten Commandments, that's a pretty good sign that you shouldn't do that thing. But again, I don't think it really helps in a lot of the gray areas. And here's really where it becomes difficult. It becomes difficult because their context is different than ours. For you and I, we don't live in a society, some people today still do, but we don't live in a society where we are forced, obligated to worship a particular religion, particular God, a particular, you know, where we have those things articulated to us and forced upon us. And so we can't just take this and flop it onto to our lives and say, okay, well, this must be about civil disobedience, this must be about not doing what the government is telling us to do. This must be about, you know, X, Y, and Z. We have to be very careful about how we apply it. But what I have to say is that our context is very different. But it still fits us. Now, in our context, we aren't commanded to worship idols. But in our context, they are offered to us, aren't they? I mean, in our context, our society, our faith, this word, they offer us tons of idols on a platter. They don't force us to worship them, but they definitely offer them to us. And I think that's kind of the part in which we have to apply and understand. In our culture, we live in a place that offers them, and we live in a place that exalts these idols, that exalts the idols of, you know, of money, that exalts the idols of comfort and pleasure, that exalts the idols of reputation and fame, that exalts the idols of status and wealth, that exalts the idols of power and influence. And you know what the world around us does in our society, in our culture, is it encourages us to pick up one of those. I mean, that's what we hear, that's what we see all the time. You know, for most of us, Daniel 3 is not about standing before an authority and refusing to worship something on pains of death. For most of us, Daniel 3 is about setting our hearts against the idols of this world and committing ourselves to setting God first, that to do anything else is to reject God, to embrace any other idol, to worship at any other altar is to deny the one who is true, the one who is real, the one who does deserve our allegiance. And I think that's where we start moving off of the text in a different way, that we live in a world that tells us that we don't need God, that we can fill our lives with different things, and it offers us all the alternatives that it has to offer. And it says, make this your meaning, make this your purpose, make this your glory. And for us, it's up to us to recognize that that's the battle that we have. The battle that we have isn't against the government because they're forcing us to worship. It's against ourselves. It's against our soul. It's against the temptations that we see around us because our culture offers these idols up on a platter and says, take, eat, enjoy, live. And for us, it's slightly different because of that. So what is our response? Right? How is our response? Because if our context is different, our response is going to be a little bit different. If you go to verse 13, we see the response of Daniel. We see the response of Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Verse 13 says that Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, horn, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And so we have essentially kind of the climax of the passage. I think a lot of times when we read this, for in our minds, it's the furnace, because that's the amazing thing. The way this is written, the way it's kind of laid out, this is actually the amazing part of the story. This is actually the part of the account that's meant to be the shock and awe of, my gosh, how do they do that? This is really kind of the meat of it. And if you notice, what they do is they're at an inflection point. They're at a turning point. They have a decision to make. They can make a decision to go along with everyone else, and again, there's certain rationalizations, or they can decide to do what they think is faithfulness to God. And we see this interesting thing that they understand that it could cost them dearly. When Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answer, they do answer in the beginning. They say, you know, that God can deliver them. But in the second half of their answer, they recognize that God might not. In other words, they understand the ramifications of their decision. They understand what might happen. Because it's not a one-to-one equivalence, we have to kind of understand what this means. For you and I, again, we're probably, unless you go on missions and serve in countries where Christians are being persecuted now, most of us won't be in a situation like this where we are spiritually kind of staring down the barrel of, you know, the gun, you know, where our lives are threatened. But I think what we should see is that for these three men who are staring down the barrel, they are willing to lose everything, even their lives. You know, if obedience to God, if faithfulness to Christ means that they have nothing, then that's fine. You know, Paul said this. If you remember, the Apostle Paul said, "To live, to die is to live is Christ. To die is gain." And John Piper said this. John Piper said, essentially, what Paul is saying is saying win-win scenario, right? If I live, I have Christ. But if I die, I get more of Christ. And it's the ultimate kind of win-win. There's no way to lose. And, you know, for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that's their understanding, is that they understand what's involved. They understand the gravity of the situation, but they see things very differently than everyone else. They see that there is a glory and a beauty. They see that there is a hope and a reward that is deeper than anyone in that moment can understand. And you know, for you and I, as we talk about idolatry, again, we're not going to be staring down the barrel of a gun. We're not going to be, you know, most of us aren't going to have our lives threatened. But the same question comes to us. Right? What are we willing to do when the idols are offered to you? When they're put on a platter, when they're dressed up, when they're presented just right, then what will you do? And let me just say, they are tempting. Right? They're absolutely tempting. Right? When you're offered, you know, when your proposition that you could make your life about wealth and all the things that could mean, when you're offered reputation, when you're offered comfort, when you're offered security, I mean, those things are hard things to push away. They're hard things to say no to. You know, I think especially in this area, we have this thing where it's so easy to compare ourselves to everyone else, to look around and say, I want what they have. I want their car, I want their house, I want their lifestyle, I want, you know, we see it right next to us sometimes in, you know, our neighbors, and I mean, those are the idols offered up to us. Now, I remember when we were living down in Haymarket, I think I've shared this years ago, but I never realized how important lawns were, right? That it's you know, that to some degree, like, it's a big deal to have a nice lawn. And I think early on, my wife and I said, you know, we don't want to have the worst lawn in the neighborhood. We don't want to have the best. But you know, you start seeing people like, there was one guy, I still remember him. I remember where the house was in the neighborhood. He was on the drive out, and I didn't see him out a lot, but I mean, this guy took meticulous care of his lawn. I mean, everything was always perfect. And I got to a point of, I almost wanted to go over to his house, knock on his door, say, God, you know, cut it out. You know, like, just let it go a little bit, like, make the rest of us feel a little better so that we don't feel this desire to kind of keep up. Just, you know, let things go a little shabby for a little while, just for our sake. I mean, that's the pull of idolatry, to say, I want what they have. You know, I want my life to be about what their life is about. And again, even though we will probably never stare down the barrel of a gun, our lives will probably never be threatened, in the moment it feels like if we make the choice, we will lose it all. If we decide that we want to be faithful, then we can lose it all. And you know, we have to be ready for that. The response of faith is to realize that there is something inherent in God himself that makes him more worthy than anything else that the idols can offer. And when you really believe that, it changes the way you think, it changes the way you act, it changes the way you deal with the world around you. And this is really kind of the part that I particularly kind of enjoy, but One of the things that I spent some time thinking about was this. For these men, as they're making this decision, as they're responding in faith, how could they be so calm, right? How could they make this decision like that? How could they make this type of decision? And how could they do it in the face of, I mean, you have to imagine, you know, the king is livid. I mean, you know, we're told here that he's enraged even before he asks and they answer. And that the moment they answer, he's so furious that he has the furnace, you know, lit up and he has more coals thrown up, more wood, and it stokes the fire. I mean, how could they knew their lives were literally in their hands at that moment. They realized that it was life or death. So, you know, how could these men make a decision like this? How could they be so calm? And we actually see it in verse 17. If you go to verse 17, in the ESV, it says this. It says, they answer Nebuchadnezzar and they say, if this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand. When you read that, there's a question that comes up. You say, they start off and they say, if this be so, and you say, what does that mean? You know, if what's true, right? If what is so, then how are they responding? This is one of those where the Hebrew is a little bit opaque. The English is a little bit opaque, but in the Hebrew, what they're essentially saying is they're saying this. They're saying, if our God exists, the one whom we serve, then he is able to deliver us. And the reason why that's actually a very interesting response, the reason why I wanted to point it out, they're not questioning God's existence, even though that could be one of the ways you interpret it. If our God exists whom we serve, then he's able to. The reason why that's actually incredibly important, that so many of the commentators point out, is that if you notice in their response, they're not focused on the king and his anger and the wrath and the possible consequences. In that moment, the only thing that matters to them is the ability and the pleasure of God. They said, if it's true that God is powerful and that he is gracious, if it is true that God is worthy and that he is good, then we know he will do this for us. We know he can do this for us. And you know, when you read that, you begin to understand where they found their strength, where they found their peace to deal with the stress. You begin to understand how they were able to stand up to the king, you know, red-faced, screaming at them to say, you know, if our God exists, the one whom we serve, then he can deliver us from your hand. See, the thing that they needed and the way that they were able to answer was because their concentration, their focus, their attention was not on their surroundings. It was about the greatness and beauty of the God that they love and they serve. In other words, they didn't care about what the king thought about them. They thought about what their God thought about them. They didn't care about what the king could do to them. They knew what God could do for them. And you know, that's the way you find strength. That's the way you find peace. That's the way you're able to say no to the idols. That's the way that you're able to look at the idols and say, look them in the eye and say, you have nothing to offer me. All you do is you spill lies. But I know the one who gives. I know the one who is good. I know the one who can rescue. I know the one who can redeem. You know, for you and I mean, that's what we need in our fight against the idols that we face. The response of faith is not a response of saying, I would rather die. The response of faith is looking at the God who loves you so. And when you see him, then you can turn and say to the idols, you are worthless. You are nothing. You know, it's amazing because the story ends with the furnace. Again, you know, most of us have seen that and read that. My favorite part of this kind of hits at the very end of it. Verse 27 says, the satraps and prefects, the governors and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over their bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of the fire had come upon them. What they said was true, right? That if our God exists, the one who is both powerful and good, he is able to deliver us. And that's exactly what happens. He delivers them. Now, does that mean that every challenge ends with a salvation like that? No. I mean, they recognize that. But the important part was they were willing to lose it all, not because they were brave. They were willing to lose it all because they were staring at a God who had everything in his hands. And if that's the God that you love and you serve, then you have nothing to fear. You have nothing to worry about. And like John Piper says, it's a win-win situation either way. The thing that I want to end with is the thing that all of us kind of notice through here, you know, as they're walking through this furnace, Nebuchadnezzar kind of looks up, he says, "Didn't we throw three men into the furnace?" And they all kind of say, "Yes, yes," and he says, "And then why are there four?" And what's amazing to me is that this passage shows us that it's in the midst of their, it's in the midst of their suffering, it's in the midst of their decision, it's in the midst of their this radical decision that they gaze upon a God who's both powerful and good, that they actually meet him. Right? They're thrown into the furnace, and the king says, "You know, who is that other one? The fourth one looks like the Son of God." And you know, what's interesting to me is for them in the furnace, they saw something that you and I see or can see anytime. You know, for them, they had to go into the furnace to see it. They went into the furnace, and in the furnace, there was a fourth walking with them. Part of me wonders, like, what did they think? What did they say? Like, what was their reaction? But for you and I, we know we can see that one, the fourth one. You know, for us, we see that perfection. We see the pinnacle of God's power and goodness in Jesus Christ on the cross. And for you and I, as Christians living in a non-Christian world, when we understand that, when we understand that that he is the one who is our delight, that he is the one who is our joy, then nothing can sway us. Nothing can pull us. And ultimately, nothing can destroy us. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you for, Lord, this beautiful, beautiful account of faithfulness of three men. We thank you that, Lord, in their conflict, we thank you that they become a beacon for us. And Lord, as much as they are examples, they are not the answer for us. Lord, they lead us to an answer, which is Jesus Christ, to the answer. And so, Father, we do want to ultimately thank you that it's Jesus, Lord. He is the one who saves. He is the one who redeems. And he is the one that if it is so, Lord, if it's true that you are a God of both power and goodness, then we need nothing else. And Lord, I pray that we, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that we stand against our idols, that we stand against the idols of this world, and we call them out and smash them down. And in doing so, that we find ourselves embraced, Lord, by a faithful God. So Lord, help us to not just to see what we do when we're different, but to enjoy being different, to enjoy belonging to another, to enjoy being aliens and strangers, because it means that we are yours. And in that delight, may we love and serve the world around us as best as we can. We thank you again, and we pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.